Okay, it says to qualify briefly. At this time, the chairperson should qualify briefly. Requirements for chairing a meeting at the Central Orlando Group Saturday night speaker meeting are 1 year of continued sobriety. Have Central as your home group and attend a group conscious meeting. I'm an alcoholic. My name is Jim Powers.
Hey,
my sobriety date is February 18, 2002, and Central is my only home group, and I go to every group conscious meeting when I'm in town because my sponsor says as long as you stay in the middle of service, you're not going to probably drink. And I don't want to drink. I don't want to hurt anybody anymore, and that's what I did for a long time. And I'm really glad to be here. And one of the thrills of being a member of this group is to pick the speakers. And I'm going to introduce the speaker in just a second, but it does say for me to remind you to please check your cell phones and turn them off. Those of you who don't know that Central records our speakers, and we don't need to hear your dial tones or your ringy-dings, so if you would do that, I would appreciate it. And I'm going to introduce the speaker. I met this lady a couple of years ago at the state convention. I was working in the hospitality suite, and I tell people I'll chew my arm off before I ever volunteer to do that again. 3,500 hungry alcoholics three times a day would hit that room, and they would just ravish us. But it was a lot of fun. It was service work. But we closed it every time there was a speaker, so A, out of respect for the speaker, and B, so we could go see the speakers. And this lady led off that state convention. She was the first speaker that night, Thursday night speaker. And, you know, somebody said it a couple months ago when they were up here, but, you know, I went up to meet her afterwards, and I said, Rose, it's real nice to meet you, you know, and you did a real good job. I really appreciate it. And she said, Jim, thank you very much. And, you know, my head swole up like that because I thought, wow, she knows who I am. I got this big badge around my neck. It says Jim on it. I mean, but anyway, her sponsor met my sponsor tonight, and I think they came from the same school because they taught us both the same thing, that when Alcoholics Anonymous calls and asks you to do something, you don't say no. And so they drove a couple hours over here, and what was amazing is, she knows this, I called Sandy Beach first down in Tampa, and he's not doing very good right now. He's canceled all the rest of his speaking engagements for the rest of the year. And so I went 2 hours from Orlando, and I called Rose. And the cool thing is, Rose was on vacation when she called me back. So not only did she not say no, she stopped her vacation and said, I'd be glad to, I'd be honored to. So how about a warm welcome for Rose?
Rose, and I am an alcoholic. And I want to thank Jim very much for giving me an opportunity to share my experience, strength, and hope. I love Alcoholics Anonymous. And it's hard to describe in words. You'll hear as I speak the difference that it's made in my life. And it's a program that I never wanted. I never wanted to be sober. I didn't think sobriety was possible for somebody like me. I didn't think a life without drinking was possible for somebody like me. And the only reason I stand before you today without a drink or a drug in my body is because of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And everything that's good in my life today is because of this program. I will qualify for you. My sobriety date is January 12, 2001. I have a sponsor who drove me over here, and I really believe she's here to make sure I don't lie to you. Imagine that, an alcoholic who would get up and tell you lies. So I'm grateful for that. It's also good to see old friends. I see Katie and Sheila and Chad, and it's always a pleasure. I love going to AA functions and meeting new friends and seeing old friends. So with that, I'll tell you a little bit about who I am. I am 49 years old. I'm originally from New Jersey. I come from an Irish Catholic family. My mother is actually a Scottish immigrant. Her parents were born in Ireland, and my father's Irish and German. So I'm Irish Catholic, so there's a possibility that there might be drinking in my family. I grew up in a family where alcoholism was present, and I don't say that for any other reason, just that it's a fact. For a long time, I thought my dad was an alcoholic because my father would drink and he would get drunk. He didn't drink every night or all that often, but when he drank, he got drunk, and I thought that that's what an alcoholic was. What I learned in this program is that my father did not have the distinct personality change that I have when I drink. My father was not a different man when he didn't have a drink or a drug in his body. I'm a different woman. So I've come to believe that perhaps he was just one of those heavy drinkers that the Big Book talks about. But I do have aunts and uncles that have been active alcoholics and sober alcoholics. So even as a kid, there was always alcohol in our lives. I remember being a very small child. and there was alcohol at every party or every function. I mean, if you're Irish Catholic, if somebody dies, you drink. If they get married, you drink. You just drink. I mean, it's always a reason to drink. And I remember as a kid tasting alcohol. Somebody would always leave a beer down or a glass of whiskey down, and I remember tasting it, and I never liked it. Never liked the taste of alcohol, and I still don't. When I drank for the effect. It was never that I thought, oh, this tastes delicious, let me have some more. It was never about that. It was about becoming a different person. I come from a family of four children. I have two older brothers and a younger sister. And I went to Catholic school, both grammar school and high school, and I had friends, and I didn't come from the broken home. I mean, there was nothing really rotten about my childhood, except that I always felt uncomfortable in my skin. I think I was an alcoholic waiting for my first drink. I don't think I ever felt right. I don't think I ever felt like I fit in. I don't think I ever felt that I was good enough or pretty enough or smart enough or anything enough. I always felt like the odd man out. I was overweight as a child. I had bright red hair. And 40 years ago, nobody had bright red hair and was considered, you know, the hot chick in class, you know? I mean, there was two redheads. There was the fat one and the thin one, and I wasn't the thin one. I had freckles and a big gap in my teeth you could drive a semi-truck through, and I was just awkward and shy and uncomfortable all the time. And my brothers were athletic and popular, and I always just kind of blended in the background. And when I was nine, my sister came along, and then she was the baby, and I wasn't the only girl anymore, and I was just a misfit all of my life. When I got to high school, I really thought that I wanted to do something different. I wanted to fit in. I wanted somebody to know me for me. I wanted Rose to be somebody. I was always Isabel's daughter or Johnny's sister or Katie's older sister. I was always somebody other than who I was, and I was going to fit in. You know, and I decided that I was going to do what all the other kids did. You know, I started smoking cigarettes because that's what you did. You hung out by the wall down, you know, away from the priests and the nuns, and you smoked. And then the next migration of that, you know, the cool club is to drink. And it was before a high school dance. I was 14 years old, and I begged my older brother to please buy me a six-pack of beer. And my brother said, I don't think that's a great idea, Rose. And you know how a little sister can bug an older brother? It becomes like a part-time job, then a full-time job. Eventually, they've had enough of you, and they just give in, and they give you what you want. And he bought me a six-pack of beer. And I'll never forget it. I can still remember it, absolutely. It was a six-pack of Rheingold Tall Boys, and I drank three of them, and my life was never the same. I remember how it felt going down, and what I remember most is that once I had that beer inside of me, everything about my life changed. It's not that I thought I was beautiful or I thought I was smarter or I was clever or funny or witty. It's just that I didn't really care that I wasn't anymore. I had found the solution to be able to live in my own skin. My whole life I've always heard everybody tell me, well, Rose, drinking is your problem. And for me, drinking was my solution. It's the only way it made my life manageable. It's the only way I could live with all of these feelings that I had, because it just kind of buried them. It just kind of kept them in a deep, dark place where I didn't have to feel it anymore. I never drank socially. I was never a person who could have a drink or two. If I only had a drink or two, it's because I had a bottle in my purse. I never had a social relationship with alcohol. From the first time I ever took a drink, I drank alcoholically. I drank with a purpose, with a mission. I drank to get drunk. I drank to get from here to there, and I always overshot there by a long way. I never knew enough to stop, and I never wanted to stop because I couldn't imagine my life any differently than how it was. It was too important to me, and I knew that. By the time I was 15 years old, I had my first bout of alcohol poisoning. I went in the woods to drink, because that's what you do, right, when you're not allowed to go anywhere else. And I went in the woods with my friends, and we climbed up on some big structure, and I drank a bottle of Smirnoff straight down. I passed out. I had to be dragged to the center of town over railroad tracks. An ambulance had to be called. I was rushed to the hospital. I had to have my stomach pumped. They had to start my heart. And the humiliation, the first alcoholic humiliation, set in. And as my mother and father came to get me at the hospital, the thought never occurred to me that I'm not really doing this right. It's not working out too well for me. The thought occurred to me that maybe next time I should probably cut it with something. I probably shouldn't drink the whole bottle of vodka straight down. See, because it was for me an answer to my lifelong prayer. I'm not giving up drinking. Even though I know I'm not doing it well, I'm not giving it up. By the time I was 16, I was hanging out in bars. I always looked a little bit older than I was. And after school, I'm with my friends in a bar. School books in the car, and I'm drinking at the bar. By 17, my father sat me down, and he told me I had all the earmarks of being an alcoholic. My father was a bartender. And if he knew anything, he knew an alcoholic, and he knew his daughter was in trouble. He knew I was different. And I remember sitting there over the dining room table, you know, those parent-children talks, where he looks over the top of his glasses and he gives you that disappointing look. And I knew when he said to me, "Rose, you have all the earmarks of being an alcoholic," I knew that he was right. I knew it was different. I knew it was too important to me. I knew my friends could go out and drink on Friday and Saturday night, and it was no big deal. And I knew I wanted it all the time. I knew that if I had something to drink, I didn't want to share it with you. And I knew that I couldn't imagine my life without it, that I looked for every single opportunity to drink. If it meant stealing booze from a neighbor, my parents, I did it. It was that important to me. And while I knew my father was right, I also knew that I had no intention of stopping. At 17 years old, you know, I'm in school, I'm getting good grades, and I only got good grades because my parents would have killed me. And I had a healthy fear of my parents. I don't think that's so true today, but I really was afraid of my parents. And I had a part-time job. I had my own car. I thought I knew everything at 17. You know, and I truly believed for a very, very long time that my drinking didn't affect anybody but me. It was my life, and I was going to live it any way that I wanted to. And while he may be right, I'm okay with it. I'm one of those people that never had a problem being called an alcoholic. I really don't care. I didn't get the unmanageability of alcoholism for a very, very long time. I graduated high school, and I think, well, I got to go to college because that's what I'm supposed to do. Everybody else is doing that, so I guess that's the way that my life is supposed to progress on. And I enroll in a local community college, and after a couple months, I realize, yeah, this isn't really for me. You know, I'm not digging this too much. So I drop out, and I go to work because I'm a worker. You know, I've always been a worker. I always had two paper routes. You know, I part-time jobs. I babysat. I'm a worker. At least that's the lie I sold myself. What I know now as a sober woman is alcohol took away my absolute desire to be anything else than what I was. No motivation, no drive, didn't really care. Existing was good enough for Rose. This is where I started to settle, where good enough is good enough for me. So I get a job, and I work hard, and then I get a better job, and I start to make more money, and then I get an even better job, and I'm working at a Fortune 500 company. I get in an entry level, and I start making a lot of money. And I love money. I love what money can buy me. I love shoes and pocketbooks and earrings and jewelry. Because all these things that I put on the outside of me make me look like I'm normal and I'm okay. And I'm dying inside. But if I look okay, you don't know that I'm dying inside. And those things were very important to me. To have the look, the right clothes, the right car. Because you thought I was okay and I wasn't. I was a full-blown alcoholic by 17. I was a blackout drinker by 20. I had no life. The only relationship I've able to sustain up until this point is with a bottle of booze. But I meet the man of my dreams. I'm 20 years old. I'm working with a great company, and I meet the man that I'm instantly in love with. The only reason I was even attracted to him is because he drank like I did. Sure. He didn't fuss around with little sissy drinks. He didn't have an umbrella in his glass. He drank. And I'd have to be with somebody like that, right? Because if I wasn't with somebody like that, I would look abnormal. I can't be with a normal person and drink the way I drink. We never dated. We never danced. I thought we did for a long time, but we never did. All that we ever did was drink together. And I was with this man for 13 years. At the beginning of the relationship, it was okay. 2 years into it, his parents and my parents got together and said, "We must separate these two. They will kill each other." It was a toxic relationship. So, of course, that pushes us closer together because Romeo and Juliet are in love. And the world is against us, so our love is even stronger. And I still date him, and I'm still living at home, and I'm 25 years old. I've been with him for 5 years. And my parents decide to move to Florida. 25 years old, I got a great job, and I'm upset because my parents are going to kick me out in the street. Where am I going to go and get a gig for $20 a week rent where I don't have to pay any other bills and I can shop and do whatever I want? So the natural progression for me was to move in with this man. That made sense to me. I should move in with this man. And although I was, like I said, a full-blown alcoholic and everyday drinker, when I moved in with him, my drinking really took off. I was drinking more than I'd ever drank before because I didn't have to sneak in the house in the middle of the night anymore. I didn't have to worry about mom and dad. I didn't have to worry about driving. You know, I could just go home from work after a hard day and knock back 1.75 liters of whiskey every night and just be who the grown-up woman that I thought I was. I didn't do anything but work and drink. That was my life. I had no social life. I didn't do anything socially at all. So I move in with this man, my drinking gets really bad, and as soon as I moved in with him, he stopped working. He retired from life altogether, and that's okay, because it's okay with Rose, because Rose settles for everything. Good enough is good enough for Rose, and I pay the bills, and I'm making the money, and I'm a functioning alcoholic. I drink every night, and I go to work every day, and I wake up every morning in a pool of my own urine, and I throw up every single day. And I kept drinking. I couldn't imagine my life without it. But he had a drinking problem, too. And I just really thought if he just clean up his act if he would get sober, that my life would get better. Because I'm doing it all. I'm drinking, but I'm doing all the other things. I'm meeting all the other requirements of being an adult, being a responsible person. I'm paying the bills. I've got money in the bank. You know, I've got the car, the clothes. I'm good. And I really believed that he was my problem. I believed if he'd gotten himself sober, my life would instantly get better. He was in and out of detoxes. He was in and out of rehabs. And on one of these particular occasions, he came home and he said, "Rose, I want to go to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm 25 years old. I know he's got a problem. I don't want to go. But I'm a good girl. I'm a good girlfriend. I'm going to go with him." So I go to my very first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. It's in a hospital. And we walk in the room and the hair on the back of my neck stands up because I don't want to be anywhere near anybody like you.
Sure.
And we sit down and this woman gets up to the podium and she says, "My name is Debbie B and I'm an alcoholic." And she starts telling her story. And I couldn't for the life of me understand how she had reached deep down inside my soul and spoke about all those things that I felt my whole entire life. How could this woman possibly know who I am? How could she know how I felt? And I started to cry. And after the meeting, she walked up to me and she said, "You don't ever have to feel this way again. There's a better way." And she did what we're supposed to do. She put her hand out there. She put the hand of Alcoholics Anonymous out there and she tried to help me. She said things like, "Don't drink and go to meetings." And I heard, "Go to meetings," and I'd show up drunk. And she'd say things to me like, "You are so willful and defiant. Until you get willing and reliant, you will never get sober." And she was right. She convinced me I should go away to rehab. I had great insurance. I signed myself into one of those fluffy, you know, celebrity kind of country club rehabs. I did the 28-day program. They give me a chip at the end that says you'll never drink again. They diagnose me as mentally ill, and I say, "Well, that's it. I'm just friggin' crazy. That's why I drink." That's the answer. I was happy to be defined as crazy. That was okay for me, because that explained it all. That explained why I was living my life the way I'm living it. Because there's no explanation to do what I'm doing, other than I must be mentally ill. So I get out of rehab. I stay sober for about 2 months. I don't do what I'm supposed to do. I take a coffee commitment here or there, but I don't get involved in AA. I don't sit in the middle of the room where I'm safe. I sit on the edge and I judge you. And next thing you know, I'm drinking again. And he's drinking again. And our lives spiraled downhill rather quickly. He had become very abusive. He became physically abusive, psychologically abusive, sexually abusive, and then physically abusive. I used to think that I was hiding all these things from people. I didn't know that when the cops come to your house on a regular basis, that there's reports and there's newspaper articles and your family's reading it and your parents know these things. I was living in such shame and fear that I thought it was my dirty little secret. I didn't know that my parents knew that I was getting beaten. I didn't know that my brothers were calling him saying it happened again. I didn't know that they were waiting for their oldest daughter to say, "Please help me, I need help." And I thought I was living this lie, and I never told anybody in my family that I relapsed. For the next 10 years, I let them think that I was sober, and it's not so hard when your family lives out of town or out of state. You just don't call them, you know? You can call anybody else at 3 in the morning, you just don't call mom and dad. You know, you can order the full set of Hee-Haw tapes and shop QVC, but don't call mom and dad. So I thought that nobody knew I was drinking. And I knew at this point that this guy was never going to clean up and I had to get rid of him. Because I still really blamed every single thing that was wrong with my life on him. I'd almost gotten enough strength up to do it. I was very fearful of him. He used to tell me things like, "I will kill you. I will kill your family. You will never get away from me." And I believed him. When you're so sick yourself, you can't tell the truth from the false. I believed he was capable of doing all these things. And I was so ashamed of the woman I was and the way I was living, I stayed. Eventually, I couldn't take it anymore. I used to spend every weekend at a hotel because I couldn't be near him anymore. And he fell down a flight of stairs and he broke his neck. And now I felt trapped. What am I going to do? I can't leave him. He's got a broken neck. What kind of a woman would I be? What would you think of me if I left this man? And I stayed. And I'm not sure if I stayed for a year and a half or 2 years, somewhere in there. And he continued to drink. And of course he continued to drink because I continued to buy it for him. Because I thought every night if I gave him just a little bit of alcohol or hid it around the house and made him search for it during the day while I was at work, that maybe he wouldn't beat me that night. Maybe it wouldn't be so bad. And eventually I couldn't take it anymore. And I was broken. I was in very bad shape. Things were falling apart. And my mother had come up from Florida to visit me. And she took one look at me and she knew something was wrong. It's something about a mother's ability to look inside her child's eyes and see their soul and know that they're falling apart. And I think that she thought it was because of this relationship with this man. She knew what was going on, and she was, in my opinion at that time, pretty much blaming him for the condition that I was in. She did not acknowledge that she thought I was drinking. She thought it was strictly the fact that I was in this abusive relationship. Well, he was in the hospital. He used to be very sick. He used to bleed from his esophagus, and he'd be rushed to the hospital, and he'd have these horrible bleeds, and he was in and out so many times, and he was in the hospital in this particular time. And all I know is I went to the hospital with my mother to visit him, and she went into his hospital room, and when she came out, she said, "You're broken up. You're no longer with this man." And I couldn't figure out why I'd been with this loser for 13 years, and my mother goes in, and 3 minutes later, I'm free. So I think my life's going to magically get better, right? Wave a wand, everything's going to get better because he's the problem. This guy's the problem. And then he's gone, and nothing's getting better. I'm sad, I'm angry, I'm lonely, I'm depressed. I'm drinking as much as I ever drank before, and I can't blame him anymore. So the problem's got to be me. The problem's got to be my drinking. I can't stop drinking. I don't want to stop drinking. Somebody like me can't stop drinking. That's all I know. That's all I have. So I thought I should try other things. I should try being social. I should try maybe going to the movies. And I could only go to like a 10 or 11 o'clock in the morning movie because I can't go to the movies at night because I got to start drinking by 4 o'clock in the afternoon. I can't drink before 4 o'clock in the afternoon because then I'll get drunk too quick and pass out and I'm up in the middle of the night. It's a lot of work being a drunk like me. So I try going to the movies at 10 o'clock in the morning. I try going shopping a little bit with my friends, and then I'm still dying inside. I'm lonely. I'm miserable. And I'm all alone, and I can't blame anybody anymore. I can't be the victim that I've been my whole life. So I decide to go out with some friends of mine one night, and that's something I didn't do. I hadn't been out socially drinking since I was in my probably late teens, early 20s, and I'm 35 years old. And they said, "Come on, Rose, you never go out, you never do anything, let's go to a bar." And I said, "You know, that's not really my cup of tea." And they said, "Come on, you never do anything." And I don't like bars, I gotta tell you, I just don't. They give you these little drinks that are ridiculous, and they're very weak, and I pay a lot of money for it, and I got to pretend to be not the drunk that I am, and I just don't have a good time. I just really don't want to do it, but I decided to do it because I was so desperately lonely. And it was November 25th, 1998, and what I didn't know, it was the night before Thanksgiving, and I didn't know that that's a big night out in the bars. All the kids come home from school, and they all congregate in the bars. And so when I got into this bar, I was instantly shell-shocked. Here I'm not a social person. I'm a hermit alcoholic. I'm in this crowded bar, and I'm not happy to be there anyway. I'm not happy to be there because I can't drink the way I need to drink. I'm going through the motions. I'm pretending to have a good time. I'm trying, but I'm not happy. I just want to go. This is not for me. And so I stood there pretending to have a good time for a couple hours, and I said, "You know, thanks a lot. This was great. I got to go." And I said my goodbyes, and because I knew I had a schedule to keep. I knew I had to get home, and then I had to get drunk, and then I had to pass out, and then I had to get up in the morning, and then I had to make myself look presentable, so when I had Thanksgiving at my brother's house the next day, I didn't look like a hot mess. So I said, "You know, this has been great. Thanks so much. Ba-boom, I'm out of here." And never for a second did it dawn on me that I shouldn't drive. I'm a professional alcoholic. I've been doing this for a lot of years. I'm not even that drunk. I've had a couple of drinks, you know what I mean? I'm not even that drunk. And it never occurred to me not to put the key in the ignition. I did it. I started to drive home, and I almost made it all the way home. I was literally around the corner from my apartment complex, and I'm a smoker, and I dropped my cigarette. And I bent over to pick up my cigarette, and I hit something. And I was absolutely certain at that moment in time that I hit a deer. I lived in a very rural area in northwest New Jersey. No sidewalks, no street lights. It was a rainy night, and fact is, I panicked. I knew I'd been drinking, even though I didn't think I was drunk. I knew the cops would see it differently. I knew I had stuff in my pocketbook that's illegal, and I never stopped. I turned the corner, I pulled my car in the apartment complex, and I went inside. I was talking to a friend of mine when I got inside, and I said, "You know, I hit a deer two streets up, and my windshield shattered, and my car's going to get damaged." And that's all I could think about was my car. That's who I am. So he said, "Rose, I've got a tarp in the car. Don't worry about it. I'll bring it over. We'll cover your windshield." And sure enough, 10 minutes later, I see him pull in, and I go out. And when we approach my car, and we go to cover my windshield. As we go to put the tarp over the passenger side, there's a chunk of hair and a part of a human forehead. And I panicked again. I said, please take me back. And he did. We turned the corner, and before we even got halfway up the street, I could see the cop cars and the ambulance, and I knew it wasn't a deer. And I knew it was bad. And I knew I was responsible. And the only thing I could say was, please take me home. And for many years, I thought I did that to protect this guy. The fact is, I did it because I was paralyzed by fear. And I didn't know what else to do. And he turned around, he dropped me off, and I went inside, and I did what... the only thing that makes sense to an alcoholic like me. And I started drinking. I didn't hide my car. I didn't run. I waited. And I knew that they would come. And eventually, a couple hours later, there was a knock on my door, and it was the Mount Olive Police, and they said, Miss Eshman, it appears as though your vehicle's been involved in an accident. We need to bring you in for questioning. They interrogated me for 5.5 hours, and they told me I struck and killed a 45-year-old man that was walking in the road. And I didn't see him because I didn't stop. I got bailed out of the police department that night because the detectives felt sorry for me. They said, please don't go to jail, Rose. Get somebody to bail you out. And a good friend of mine showed up with a wad of cash, and I got out. And I knew my life was never going to be the same. I knew that whatever was going to happen was too much for somebody like me, and there's only one answer, and that's suicide. I can't do this. The jig is up. Not only is the whole world going to know that I'm not sober, I have killed someone. My parents got on the phone. They begged me to get help. They told me to get an attorney, and I did those things because I didn't know what else to do. I got an attorney. I went in and checked myself into a psychiatric unit. After 11 days, they said, well, you got to get out of here, but you're really not well enough to go home by yourself. And they sent me to a crisis house for adults. And I did, again, what makes sense to an alcoholic like me. I had an affair with my counselor. Because if I'm paying attention to you, I don't have to look at me. And I tried going to AA, but I didn't care because all I wanted to do was die. Because there's no answer to this. There's no way out of this. I can't do this. And I kept trying to kill myself. I tried 4 or 5 times. Eventually, this man said, this counselor, who I was started dating once I was released from this crisis house, and he had asked me to move into his home, which was a big mistake. I look back and I think, wow, I was sick, but he was sicker. You know, why would you invite this into your house? Right? Anyway, so I'm living with him, and he tells me, Rose, if you drink one more time, you have to go. Or you don't tell somebody like me not to drink. He goes to work, I go to the liquor store. Nobody's going to tell me what to do. And true to his word, he said, you got to get out of here. And he put me on a plane to Florida. And I came down to Florida, and I knew, unfortunately, that that was going to have to be the place that I was going to kill myself. I was waiting during this time period to take my case to trial. And the only reason I ever took my case to trial was never because I thought I was innocent. I knew that I wasn't. I mean, it was really simple. I drank, I drove, I killed somebody. I'm not innocent. But I really believed that if I could go into a courtroom and I could let them see me and I could apologize to this man's family and let them know I'm not a monster, I made a really bad mistake, that somehow it would appease the blackness in my soul because I couldn't get past it. Before I moved to Florida, I used to drive by the scene of the accident 6 times a day. And I'd look at it and say, how could this have happened? How could it have gotten this bad? And then I look over my life and say, how could it not have happened? You're a train wreck. You're a nightmare. Of course this happened. So I end up in Florida, and my parents are doing everything that they can do to save their daughter. They used to take me, and I didn't realize at the time how powerful this was. They knew I was losing my mind. They knew I was falling apart. I couldn't put a noun before a verb in a sentence. I was falling apart. And my mother and father used to take me to the beach just to watch the sunset, to give me 5 minutes of peace. And that didn't even work. Nothing worked. All I wanted to do was get booze and kill myself. One day I took that walk, you know, because I'm going to go to the liquor store. Because they did everything they could to keep me away from drinking. And, of course, there's, you know, a liquor store 2 blocks this way, but I walked 9 miles that way. And my father came out looking for me. And he never said a word. He pulled the big, you know, car over, and I got inside, and I had a duffel bag, because every good alcoholic woman carries a duffel bag. And I put it down, and he drives me home in silence, and we get into the driveway, and as I go to get out of the car, he grabs my duffel bag. And he walks inside, and he doesn't say a word to me. And he opens a bottle of whiskey, and he pours it down the drain, and I said, "Please don't do that. I can't do this. I can't do this anymore." My dad said, "Baby, I love you." And I didn't understand how hard that was for him to do. I just knew that I couldn't live like this anymore. I can't do this anymore. I was losing hope. My brother-in-law had found recovery in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. And he had come to my parents' house for dinner. And he said those awful words that people like you say. He said, "Rose, I'm going to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous tonight. Would you like to go?" I never hated him more than I hated him at that moment. And I looked at my dad. I'm 36 years old. I'm not a kid. I look at my dad, and he looks again at me over his glasses, and he says, "Baby, I don't think you have a choice." And I went to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous in Florida. And I sat and I looked at my shoes because I couldn't look at any of you. I was so ashamed of who I am. And I cried, and all I could get out was, "My name is Rose, and I'm an alcoholic." And every day, he picked me up and dragged me to another meeting. And I hated him. And every day I went, month after month, and finally it started to get better. And I thought, well, maybe there's hope. Maybe I can do this. And I started corresponding and talking on the phone with this man who kindly asked me to leave his home. And, of course, I'm in love again, so he becomes my higher power. I start making trips back to New Jersey. AA doesn't become as important to me anymore. I'm not drinking, but I'm not recovering either. And on one of these trips, I get a call from my sister who said, "Rose, please get home. Dad's very ill." And I flew back down to Florida, and within 30 days, my father died. But this is what I know. I held his hand the moment he passed from this world. I was sober, and I got to say those things I needed to say. "I'm sorry I stole your peace of mind. I'm sorry I took your ability to trust. I'm sorry I hurt you." Nothing specific, just those big general things. And as soon as my father died and I helped my mother pack up her life a little bit, I decided I needed to go back to New Jersey. Didn't occur to me that I'm running out on a woman who's just lost her husband. Didn't occur to me how selfish I am that my mother is going to be sending her oldest daughter to trial soon. It only occurred to me to do what I needed to do for me. I'm so selfish and self-centered. So shortly thereafter, I boarded a plane to New Jersey. I don't think my feet were on the ground, and I started drinking again. But I'm with this guy, and I'm happy, right? And I'm drinking. And he eventually says the same thing again. He says, "Rose, if you drink again, you gotta go." He goes to work, I go to the liquor store. It's really just that simple for someone like me. Sure enough, the next day, I'm at Newark Airport. He paid $750 one way to send me back to Florida. My sponsor and my sister picked me up at Tampa Airport, and my sister said, "How are you?" And I said, "I'm drunk, and I'm pregnant." And I knew it. I knew when I picked up the first drink I was pregnant. I never took a test. I knew. I felt it. Something was different. I've never been married. I don't have children, and I knew. And I kept drinking. So I get back to Florida, and from that day forward, I went to a meeting every single day. And after that meeting, I got drunk. I cannot explain to you what it's like to be actively drinking and actively attending meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. To sit in the room and not make eye contact because you're a liar. To not be able to share because you have nothing to share because you're a liar. To be sitting and dying inside, watching a clock tick away, hoping no one will call your name because you have nothing to say because you're a liar. Eventually, in January of 2001, I boarded a plane and I headed back to New Jersey to stand trial. My trial lasted 3.5 weeks. During the course of the trial, I had a miscarriage, which is a blessing. God knows the damage I did to that child because I never stopped drinking or doing anything else that crossed my path because I couldn't. And when I miscarried, I again became more hopeless than I'd ever been before because now I've killed this man I'm standing trial for and I've killed an innocent child. What kind of a piece of garbage am I? At the end of 3.5 weeks, they found me guilty, and they shackled me right in the courtroom and took me off to the county jail. They did not sentence me, and I knew I could be bonded out in between my conviction and my sentencing. And my mother was staying with my brother. She was there every single day with me during my trial. And I called her and I begged her to please bond me out. I can get bonded out. It's only $50,000. I didn't understand why my mother didn't have $50,000 in her back pocket, ready to bond me out. No property, no bond, $50,000 cash. And I couldn't comprehend how this woman who 3 months before has buried her husband and has now watched her child be convicted of this heinous crime wouldn't take $50,000 and get me out of jail. And I called her 50 times from the holding cell, and she'd hang up on me, and I'd call her again and again and again. And eventually she showed up at the jail. My mother is from Scotland, as I mentioned, and she's 4'11". And she looked at me through the two-way glass, and she said, "Rosellen, I love you, but I'm going to save your life. I'm not getting you out of jail." And my attorney said, "Isabel, you can bond her out." And she said, "Who's going to save her? Are you? Are you going to watch her? Leave her there." And she did. She left me there for 4.5 months until I was sentenced. I was sentenced in June of 2001 to 12 years and 30 days in a state prison. In New Jersey, there's only one female facility for women, and it's in Clinton, and it has 1,200 women. And when I got there, I will remember forever the sound of those gates that close behind you. And I knew that they had made a terrible mistake, that I don't belong here, that I'm not like these people. Only to realize I'm exactly like these people. I'm exactly where I'm supposed to be. I got a consequence for a choice that I made. But I didn't get that. I didn't know that. All I know is I'm angry. I'm very angry. I also know that in 12 years and 30 days, I will drink again. I'm in prison, and the thought has still not occurred to someone like me that I won't drink again. This is a temporary setback, because I don't imagine my life without alcohol in it. And I'm pissed. And they have a program available to inmates in the maximum security part of the prison where I was, because I'm a violent offender, so I have to do my first half of my time in maximum security. And it was Al-Anon. Never understood that. Still don't. 85% of all inmates that are incarcerated are for drugs or alcohol, and yet you've offered me the program of Al-Anon. Well, thank you very much. I'm not here because my mother drinks. And I was pissed. I was insulted and pissed. So I didn't go to any of those silly meetings, and I'm angry. Eventually, after I do 3 years in the maximum security, I get reclassified to the minimum security part of the prison, and I get involved in a program called Puppies Behind Bars. The reason I did this was I couldn't stand myself anymore. I was so filled with hatred. I still wanted to die. I still wanted to drink. I thought maybe if I could distract myself from me, that maybe this time would be a little easier, because the time was starting to do me. So I get involved with this program. I work with dogs. I realize I love this. And after I'm in the program for about 4 or 5 months, they give me my very own dog to raise. Into my arms, they placed an 8-week-old black Labrador retriever named Sandy. And my life changed. This dog loved me. And I had forgotten what that was like. I have spent my whole life building walls around me, armor around me to protect me from you, from it, from them, from whatever. And one by one, this dog took each brick out of that wall. And I realized she didn't care who I was or what I'd done or what I looked like. She didn't judge me. She loved me. And it melted my heart. And I thought, well, maybe I'll try the AA meetings that they have here in prison, because in minimum security they actually did have AA. And I started going, and I did the best that I could, and I realized the problem was me. I realized that here I am in prison, and I've been freer than I've ever been my whole life. I don't wake up wondering what I said or did the night before. I don't have that horrible blackness in my soul. The problem is me. Eventually, I became eligible for parole, and I was certain, because I'm not like the glass is half empty alcoholic. My glass is dry. It's bone dry. There's no hope. It's all hopeless. I'm very dramatic. You know, I'm never going to get paroled. I'll die an old woman in here. Anyway, I go through the process, and not only do I get paroled, but I got paroled via the interstate compact, and I got to do my parole time in Florida. After 6 years and 3 days, I was released. I boarded a plane, and I was on my way back to Florida. I realized when my brother picked me up at the Edna Mann Correctional Facility for Women and dropped me off at Newark Airport, as I stood there with my khakis on, my khaki coat that said inmate, which I promptly put into the garbage, boop, really don't want everybody in the airport knowing you're a convict. And I went inside. I knew I didn't know what to do. I knew I didn't know how to go through security. Everything's different now since 9/11, and I was filled with fear. It had been so long since I'd had an original thought, since I'd made a decision for myself. I didn't even know how to get through security. And I'm standing in line. You know, I've got my sweatpants and my gray sweatshirt, and I've got all I have is a little packet of information with my prison ID, my plane ticket. I got nothing. And I'm waiting, and these two women in front of me are just complaining that they have to take their shoes off to go through security. Interesting that I'm behind them. So I'm thinking to myself, well, my security checkpoints have been far more invasive. I'll strip naked, spread them, cough, do whatever you want, just let me through. And I did. I got through, and I ate at every place in the whole airport. And eventually I landed in Florida. My sister picked me up, and it was a moment not to be believed. And I was fearful. And I didn't know what to do. But I knew I had to get to the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. I know for an alcoholic like me, I will become isolated. I will become suicidal. And I will drink again. That's what I know about me. I will drink again without something. And I went to my very first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I don't share. I don't like to talk very much. Hard to believe, right? But I really don't share. My sponsor hits me in meetings. Say something. And I walked into the meeting, and when I opened the door, the woman standing on the other side of the door was my one friend in Florida, my one friend who had come to see me while I was in prison and brought all of your literature with her. And I knew it was a God moment. It was my first God moment. And I like to pretend to blend in the background. And when they asked if anybody was new or coming back, I put my hand up and said, my name is Rose, and I just got out of prison. And I knew I was on my way. If I would remain willing, I had a chance at this life. I also knew that I had to listen to what you said, because I've never done that before. I've never listened to what you said. And I was told to get a temporary sponsor. And I did that. And then I was told to get a permanent sponsor. And I was petrified. Who's going to want to help somebody like me? I'm a piece of garbage. Nobody's going to want to help me. And I watched this woman. I was very attracted to her because she had that AA glow. I think it's psychosis sometimes, but that AA glow. I love AA. She's like the AA cheerleader, you know? And I knew that I had to love AA. I knew I couldn't do it halfway. I knew I had to love it or I was going to drink again. I knew I had to become involved or I was going to drink again. I knew that about myself. But I was afraid to ask her. And everywhere I'd go, there she was. If I went to a meeting, there she was. If I went to Walmart, there she was. And she'd walk up and say, don't you just meet the nicest people in Walmart? There she is again. It's like the Eyewitness News van. For anybody who's from like the Tri-State area, it's this van that just keeps going by. There she is. So eventually, I asked her. And I'm filled with fear, right? Because who wants to help? You know those nicknames? Everybody in AA has a nickname. Well, I'm like Rose from prison, you know. Nobody's going to want to help me. So I ask her, and she says these words. I was hoping you would ask. And she did for me what I can't even just describe to you. She kept me out of my own way. She dragged me everywhere. She dragged me to meeting after meeting after meeting because I couldn't find a job. I'd had a job when I first got out. My brother-in-law got me a job. You know that same bum that dragged me to all the AA meetings? Well, he got me a job, and that I was laid off because it just wasn't strong business, and I was looking for a job, and it's hard. It's hard because I'm a convicted felon. It's hard because part of my sentencing was the day I was released from prison. I lost my license for 15 years. So now I'm a convicted felon with no driver's license looking for a job in Florida. Not so easy, right? So she dragged me everywhere. And she dragged me to the prison to put money on somebody's books. Or she dragged me to the post office. She dragged me meeting after meeting after meeting after meeting. And she encouraged me to do the steps because I was in so much pain. And she said, when you are in enough pain, you will do the work. And she used to say things. I'd call her up and I'd tell her I'm coming out of my skin. And she'd say, well, start the lawnmower, mow the lawn. I'll be over with my weed whacker. And she'd come over and we'd do the lawn. She got me out of my own way. I cannot stress proper sponsorship enough. If it wasn't for somebody like her who loved me the way she did and showed me, she didn't tell me, she showed me how AA works, I wouldn't be standing here. Because there's that moment that comes in all of our sobriety where you say, is this all there is? This is all there is, I don't want it. There's that moment, in your, at least in mine, where you know the only thing between you and that drink is a relationship with a higher power. Mm-hmm. See, I couldn't get the relationship with the higher power because I was so full of shame. So full of shame because I didn't do the work. But I held on to the rooms and the people in the rooms because they could do something I couldn't do. I could stop drinking any day of the week, but I can't stay stopped. So I held on to those people. And she led me through. And she loved me in spite of who I was. She taught me it was okay to trust a woman. See, I've always stayed away from women. Because I'm afraid of you. I'm afraid that you can see me for who I really am. I'm more comfortable with men. And she always used to say, and I apologize for the language, stick with the women. Men will pat you on the ass, but women will kick you in it. And she was right. She'd say things to me like, I think you should go to women's meetings. If you've been in jail for 6 years and 3 days, you're not looking for a women's meeting. I'm looking for a man. I'm on a manhunt. You know, I'm looking for my next higher power here. And she knew what she was talking about. And we look back now at the men that I chose. Oh, boy, you should see those guys. Whoa, was I sick. Holy cow. But I did what she told me to do because I didn't know how to do it on my own. If I want what she has, I got to do what she does, right? And eventually, when I stopped looking for a man, he found me. And he's a good man. And he's a sober man. And he teaches me every single day of my life how to be a better person. I always fancy myself a little bit better than him, and I'm going to admit it, because I have a little bit more time. Well, time doesn't mean anything. Sometimes I hear the most profound things from the newest person in the room. Sometimes I forget who I am. And he reminds me. And he does the right thing. And what I've learned is I need Al-Anon. Big time. Because I think I can fix him. I think he should do it my way. And he always makes good decisions. I don't know why I think I need to be his God, but I do. So I try to just do my program, because it's a lot of work to do his inventory and mine at the end of the day. So I try just to do my own and leave his alone. I eventually did find a job, and I'll tell you a little bit of a story about that. My sponsor assured me that all of your needs will be met in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. That doesn't mean all of your wants will be met. It means all of your needs will be met. And I was working a couple days here cleaning houses for people in the program because they were gracious enough to give me jobs. I would work at a car wash a couple of days, and eventually, my friend Kristen said, ask that lady over there for a ride. She's really good about giving rides because I don't drive. I'm ride dependent. And so I thought, oh, geez, I hate asking anybody. You know, I'm such a martyr. I don't want to ask anybody. So eventually, this lady at this meeting slides this paper across with her phone number on it because, you know, they all know about prison Rose doesn't drive. And she says, if you ever need a ride to a meeting, call me. Score! I don't have to call, right? She just gave me her number. So she picks me up for a meeting Monday. And on the way to the meeting, she asks me, how's that job search going? I know you're looking for a job. And I'm like, yeah, not so good. And she told me about this place that was hiring. I'm like, yeah, okay. So the next week she picks me up again. She said, how's the job search going? And I'm like, yeah, not so good. And so she said, I really think this place is hiring. And I'm like, yeah, okay. So the next week she picks me up and she, not that bright. She picks me up and she says, how's that job search going? And I go, yeah, not so good. And she goes, well, I think this place is hiring. And I said, what is that place? She goes, I own it. Show up on Thursday. Not very bright. Not very bright. And I've been working for her for the last 6 years. I started answering her phones, and now I manage her business. She's shown me what it's like to pay it forward, to give it back, to give somebody like me a chance. I have a life today that is beyond my wildest dreams. I have a life today that I do not deserve. I have a chance to become a woman. I think of integrity, of character. I have a chance to be the woman I think I always was until I made that left turn. I know that I know that I know that I know that a drink won't fix me today, and I was pretty pissed when I realized that. Somewhere in the back of my head, in my back pocket, I had that little card that said, you can go to the liquor store when this doesn't work out. And I kept coming, and I listened, and I did the work, and I did the steps, and I made my amends, and I just know that that's not going to work for somebody like me. I go to meetings because you remind me constantly of who I am and who I can become once again if I forget that I'm an alcoholic. I love the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. I have a life that I do not deserve because of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm grateful that you people welcomed me and loved me and showed me how to do it. You didn't just speak words to me. You showed me through actions. I don't know what else to say except if you're new, stick around. It'll get worse and then it'll get better and then it'll get worse, but you don't have to drink about it. My life today is a life that I can't even describe in words. The opportunities that I've been given because I didn't pick up a drink today are beyond belief. I shouldn't be standing here in front of you, but yet I've been given another chance. And I heard a man say this once, and I really believe it. They always have that expression, the only way to keep it is to give it away. I think the only way to get it is to give it away. So thanks for letting me share.